It's time for another Melissa in the Morning Scam Alert.
And here I thought we were just going to be heating up our homes, but apparently imposter scams are heating up during the holiday season. Joining us to tell us about these scams and what you need to be aware of is Jared Lawrence with Eversource. Jared, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Morning, Melissa. I'm doing well, and I appreciate the opportunity to join your program this morning to spread awareness about scams.
Absolutely. I know that we've seen this, unfortunately, in Connecticut in the past. I know residents have also fallen. Unfortunately, they've been targeted by fraudsters in this regard before. So first of all, can you tell us what the scam is?
Yeah, well, so there's what unfortunately we have to call the classic scam because it's been around for a long time. And that's when a customer, sometimes it's a residential customer, sometimes it's a small business, gets a call out of the blue. It might be at a particularly stressful time of the day, and the caller says that they are delinquent on their utility bill for some reason. They might make up some excuse as to, you know, a failed bank payment or transaction or something like that. And they tell the customer that a truck is on their way to disconnect their electricity and that they have to make a payment right then and there in order to avoid that disconnection. They're trying to get that customer to act, you know, in the pressure of the moment, to catch them off guard so they don't, you know, stop and think and check their records. And typically, you know, one of the biggest signs that it's a scam is that the caller will be very prescriptive about how the customer has to make a payment to avoid the disconnection. And so that's one of the first signs. They'll maybe direct the customer to go get a prepaid card, or they might, in some rare cases, ask for Bitcoin. But there will be some high pressure tactics, and they'll be very prescriptive about what the customer is supposed to do to avoid the supposed disconnection.
I'm curious how they know who to target. Do you have any information on that, Jared?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that you know, and I've been studying these scams for the better part of 7 years. It's really just a numbers game for them. I honestly believe that they're you know, working in some sort of typically offshore call center where they just decide what utility territory they're going to target that week. And they open up Google Maps and they start just picking addresses and phone numbers and things that they can find online. It's all about the volume for them. They don't spend a lot of time researching a customer. They don't spend a lot of time, trying to, you know, steal customer information in advance. It's just all about making those calls in high volume and seeing whom they can catch off guard. Sometimes they use robocalls. Sometimes it's a live call. But they're great social engineers, so they create the impression that they have a lot of information about the customer, but they really are trying to get somebody who is attentive on the phone, and then they start to draw that information out to make their scams more effective.
I tell you, if only they'd used their smarts for good, we probably would have solved, like, world hunger at this point. I don't know.
I agree with you, Melissa.
We've got Jared Lawrence here, who is with Eversource, and we're talking about these imposter scams. Basically, these are fraudsters, and they're posing as Eversource representatives, and they're using sophisticated, intimidating tactics to get money and personal information out of you. And another thing that Eversource has talked about several times on this show, Jared, is that you encourage people to shop around, to check third-party suppliers and see if you could find lower energy costs. But this is another way that scammers will try to dupe you into believing you found a better solution for your energy costs, but it could actually be a scam. Is there a reputable website that people should only be using if they wanted to check prices?
Yes, energizect.com is the source for supplier information in Connecticut. So anybody who's calling them up with an offer that sounds attractive and something they might want to be interested in should use that website as the resource to explore their supply options. To your point, Melissa, there are, you know, a wide range of competitive suppliers, and the vast majority of them are reputable and do and are reaching out to customers in responsible ways. It's really just those who use those high pressure tactics and maybe try and blur the line between Eversource and them to try and gain more credibility. Those are the ones that we're concerned about. But again, those are different from the offshore criminals that are executing the utility imposter scams that. That is the focus of this week.
Yeah, certainly. Now, Jared, I want to just help people to just know the facts. Because one of the things that scammers are really good at is they know you're vulnerable. They know that if you're being told, if you don't pay this bill by the end of this week, we're shutting off your power or your heat or whatever it may be. And we're in a very busy time of the year, right? The hustle, the bustle, the holidays, the travel, the schools, the work schedules, like everything is all exploding at once. It's all good for the most part. But we're sort of all over the place. So that's kind of why scammers kind of come out of the woodwork in droves during the holidays, because they know they can get more bang for their buck. They know they can scatter you and make you nervous, and you could do impulse things without realizing, wait, this is clearly a scam. So what are some specific tips that Eversource has for customers so that they know it's either you're getting this from an Eversource worker or you're getting it from a fake. You're getting it from a poser claiming to be with Eversource.
Yeah, well, thank you, Melissa, for asking that question. So I think the key point here is that Eversource, we are always wanting to work with our customers to avoid disconnection. So if a customer is feeling pressured in any way and is not being, you know, offered opportunities to work with us, and that's really the first tip. But the main signs are the fact that when a customer falls behind on their bill, they will start to receive notifications on their bill and in the mail and also through any other communications channels that they've registered with us. So a phone call 45 minutes before the supposed disconnection would never be the first time that a customer is notified about a legitimate delinquent status on their account. And also, too, the other key point is that we understand that scammers are active in the market. And so if for whatever reason, the customer was distracted, to your point, with all the activity this time of year, and maybe missed some of those notifications, if we're contacting a customer to let them know that they're in that delinquency status and they're just concerned because of all the scam activity, and they tell us, well, you know, I appreciate you giving me a call, but I'm not sure I trust you. You mind if I call back on the Eversource line on my bill? We would say, absolutely. We certainly understand. You know, feel free to give us a call back on the number that you see on your bill to validate that this is legitimate. So a scammer will, on the other hand, do everything they can to keep you from using those legitimate communications channels that are listed on your bill or on the Eversource.com website.
And I just want to let you know that Jared Lawrence actually founded what's called the UUAS. And for people who are not familiar with this, it's a really great resource. Utilities United Against Scams. And it talks about this in length. There are resources on this website. There are things that you should look out for, common scams and signs. And you should check out that website. It is utilitiesunited.org, all spelled out, utilitiesunited.org. And Jared Lawrence, I want to thank you so much for coming on to outline what is going on, unfortunately, during this time of year, and for giving those helpful tips, because again, I think this is the prime time for scammers to really hone in on people's scatteredness, vulnerability, and maybe not realizing that this is clearly a scam, but in the chaos of life, we don't realize it in real time. So thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa. The key is awareness. And so every opportunity that we have to get out the word about scams is a good effort for our customers. So I appreciate the opportunity today.
Of course. And I agree with you. The more we talk about it and make it real life and normalize it, the more aware people will be. And again, we've talked about these kinds of scams before with the Better Business Bureau, and the importance of, if you are listening to the radio, you hear about these scams, pass it on. If you have children who are in their 30s and 40s, or you've got grandkids who are just getting out into the world, they're in their 20s, and they could fall into this kind of a scam, share this information with them. Let them know. Go to utilitiesunited.org. You can share that website with them, but share this information with them, because again, especially when you've got brand new homeowners and you've got younger, you know, parents who've got kids running around, the holidays, there's a lot happening, and maybe they don't have time or they're not interested in listening to talk radio. That's fine, but you are, and we appreciate that. So share this information and make sure that they know about it. Plus, don't forget bbb.org/scam tracker. If you ever come across one of these fake poser, imposter scams, organizations, people, businesses, whatever, make sure you report them to bbb.org/scam tracker. Joining us now is Bill Gerber, who is the first selectman-elect in the town of Fairfield. And Bill, welcome back to the show. I know you and I, we spoke the early mornings after Election Day last week, and there was still a lot of uncertainty up in the air, but we're pretty certain this morning that you are going to be the new leader of Fairfield in the coming weeks. So good morning and congratulations to you. Thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here. Yeah, I think we can say I'm the presumptive first selectman elect. I think that's what people are saying at this point. It's all new to me. I haven't been through this before.
And I mean, you've heard from the incumbent, Brenda Kupchick. She did call you and congratulate you. Have you heard from her?
She did call me, and we had a nice conversation, and we are going to be meeting about transition. So, yes, I think I'm the first selectman now.
Well, congratulations to you, Bill. I know that this was probably a very, we knew it was a very intense race in Fairfield. And my gosh, I mean, razor thin, the fact that there was a 37 difference in votes between the two, you know, just shows how close the race was and how much that Fairfield cares about their local politics. So good news for Fairfield. You have a very engaged audience. I'm curious, from your perspective as the Democratic candidate, now winner of the election, how do you now approve the over 5,000 or so voters who wanted to go with Brenda Kupchick?
Well, you know, there, and I have to say, I think that was a very mixed group of people. It was not all Republicans. It was Republicans and Democrats, and a lot of I'm a Democrat. A lot of Republicans and unaffiliates voted for me. It was an interesting election. I think, you know, I knocked on a lot of doors, and our team knocked on over 20,000 doors. And I met a lot of Republicans and unaffiliated, you know, conservative unaffiliated voters who they liked talking numbers with me. And you know, I might knock the door, and they'd be a little skeptical at first, and we have a conversation about, you know, accounting and numbers and internal control environments and all those things that, you know, people have worked in large and small and corporations and own their own businesses. And by the end of the conversation, they, you know, they felt comfortable with me, whereas I did knock a lot of Democrat doors. It hurt me a little bit to talk to someone who was, you know, a couple of people who were really just wonderful people had always been Democrats their whole lives, and they said, you know, I'm just not ready to vote for a Democrat yet because of what happened during the last administration, before Brenda.
I was going to ask you about that, Bill. I am going to be honest. That was one of the things that I do know just from growing up in Fairfield. I still have a lot of family friends. My own parents still live in Fairfield. And whether they were unaffiliated or even Democratic voters, they were uncertain because of the mess that, quite frankly, was left behind by Mike Tetreault and obviously some other former employees for the town of Fairfield. What is your response? Because for people who have some skepticism around the illegal dumping situation that, by the way, taxpayers are still going to have to foot the bill on, what is your response to people who are feeling a little uneasy about a Democrat back in office for first selectman of Fairfield?
Yeah, and I totally understand it. And, you know, it's an interesting dilemma these days when there's not a lot of in-depth reporting at the local level. You know, we used to have papers, you know, with five people in the office that were out, you know, actually looking at the minutes and the source documents and watching the
those are the old days of journalism. I hear you, Bill.
Yeah,
that's what we're trying to do here on WICC. But you're right; it's very hard to find that in most media. You're correct. Yeah,
it is hard, and we do have some fantastic young reporters now. But you know, they're sort of by themselves. You know, they're covering all of Fairfield, in some cases Fairfield and Bridgeport. So, I felt like I had to sort of educate people. Number one. And this didn't fly with everyone, but you know, I knew nothing, and my colleagues on the RTM knew nothing about what was going on at the fill pile. And we were, you know, as apart from what was going on with the Tetro administration as anyone in Fairfield, including the Republicans. And we didn't find out until it hit the papers. So, and when I say find out, I mean find out that there were people internally that were involved. You know, I think the fact that Julian, the external, you know, contractor, that there was an issue there, that was much earlier. But the fact that there were actually people complicit, I think that was in early August, August 6th of 2019. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when that hit, you know, we all sort of, many of us went and voted for Brenda Kupchick.
Right, right. Well, because I was going to say, you voted for Brenda Kupchick. You supported her campaign.
I did.
Yeah.
And also, I always knew and liked Brenda Kupchick. So, yeah. You know, she was supportive of our annual fundraising event for pediatric cancer research. She would come and help out. And so it was, it really wasn't until, Brenda became first select woman that, I got to interact with her in that capacity. And I tried to be as supportive as I could. But what I saw was that the issues with Fairfield that led to the fill pile, which many of these were purchasing policies, mm-hmm. that were either not in place or not being followed if they were in place, and just a general control and also legal review of how those were done and how whether or not the Board of Selectmen, you know, reviewed in public contracts, things like that. And I didn't see, you know, we had a charter review, charter revision process, and none of the things that I viewed as could have helped, you know, mitigate that in the future were proposed. And I think that's sort of when I made up my mind.
So more structure. You want more structure and accountability.
A professional, tight structure that rivals the corporate world where, you know, we just and not that the corporate world's perfect, but, you know, the better run corporations with controls, we should have those structures in place in Fairfield.
So we have Bill Gerber here, who is the first selectman-elect for the town of Fairfield. And we were just talking about the fill pile situation that is still being cleaned up. And you know, I do have to give kudos to the fact that Brenda Kupchick, I was reminding people, entered into office with this, like you said, no one really saw this coming. It kind of just came out in the papers and it's like, wait, what? So that happened, and then it was like a few months later, boom, COVID happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So really a messy situation that she walked into, I would say. But you're kind of in the same place, though, Bill Gerber. I mean, so you're not walking into COVID, knock on wood, hopefully. We have no more COVID incidents happening like we did in 2020. But you're walking into a situation where the fill pile thing is not done. And right now, Fairfield is in probably the fight of its life right now with this monopole situation and trying to fight putting the lines underground. And so there's still a lot that has to be addressed in Fairfield. Certainly, you have a tall order for Fairfield, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, we do. And I don't view, you know, UI is unique. I mean, you know, dealing with utilities appears to be somewhat unique. And so they're very powerful, and that's going to be a challenge. But I, you know, we're going to put our resources against that. That for me is a lot more than ugly poles that are going to loom over the landscape. There's real economic impact, a negative impact on the town throughout the town from one end of town to the other. And I don't think we can allow it to happen. At least, you know, we can't. We've got to fight really hard against that. And we are going to.
So we have Bill Gerber here, who is the first selectman elect in Fairfield. Bill, really quick before we get back into the conversation, when does the transition, like the transitional team, happen? When are you sworn in? When is that set to happen?
So So the swearing in is scheduled for the 27th of this month.
Okay.
And the transition, we're going to start meeting as early as Monday with the administration.
Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. You know, I do want to talk about actually what the beginning of this conversation was about, because obviously we're going to see how, you know, how the news unfolds, what's going on, and we've been really covering some of the issues that, that Fairfield's been dealing with, and I know you and I have addressed this on the show. I do kind of want to go back, though, to the election process. And the reason I say that is because when I saw, I think it was News 12 Connecticut, did a really excellent job. John Craven covered the recount. I was actually pretty surprised at how divided Fairfield is. Now, I grew up in Fairfield, spent most of my life in Fairfield. My parents still live there.
Yeah.
Didn't realize how incredibly divided our town is when it comes to politics. And again, going back to a 37 vote difference is pretty, I mean, it was like a 50-50 essentially. And so I'm a little concerned about how do you bridge that gap? How do you bring two parties really together in Fairfield and address the concerns of your residents?
Yeah, I look at it a little differently in that I think my race with Brenda was if you just looked at that, you might think we're incredibly divided. But Brenda's a unique politician. And, you know, if you look at the other races, it really wasn't, you know, it really skewed one way, to, you know, towards Democrat. And it was like a resounding, I would say, victory for the Democrats. Brenda's unique in that she appealed, you know, across, you know, party lines. She's very heavily invested in many, you know, she's been, you know, on the Board of Ed. So there were parts of town where people of all, you know, political persuasions, you know, supported her from the days on the Board of Ed. And then as a state rep, and she's been in a lot of ribbon cuttings, and she's, you know, handed out a lot of, you know, Eagle Scout, you know, awards and things like that. So it really isn't divided across, I don't believe, across party lines. Because like I said, I had support from some very conservative Republicans as well as some very liberal Democrats. And, you know, it was based on, you know, my background and my affinity for doing deep analysis and looking at numbers. So I think it's more if the division, the real division, isn't as much as you would think by looking at my race. So I'm not sure whether you would agree or not. I would love to hear your opinion, but I do think was a lot of
I don't know, and I don't know if my opinion really matters. I was kind of like taken aback when I watched the recount. When I watched, like I said, John Craven did a package that I thought was great. But it really, to me, I couldn't believe like how, and I get it, it's a recount, right? I mean, and it's a very close race, so I get it. But I mean, it was like people were out for blood. It was intense. It was vicious.
It was intense and it was vicious.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that reflects the actual numbers of people in town. I'm not sure that people in town really appreciated that. I would think across party lines, there were probably people watching that thinking, this isn't where I want to be. Republican, Democrat, whatever. I think that is a party apparatus problem where, where people think they have to be that way and act that way. And, you know, I would suggest maybe, at that level, you know, people need to realize where they are, because I think a lot of Fairfielders were watching that and were pretty horrified.
Yeah, I would agree. And again, we have Bill Gerber here, who is the first selectman elect for the town of Fairfield, set to be sworn in later this month. Can we talk about also campaigning really quick, Bill? Because it is very hard to keep track of where I've heard, you know, quotes from other places.
Right.
It could have been when you were on Lisa Wexler's show. It could have been when you were on another show. I'm not sure. But I believe I heard you make a quote that was something to the effect of, these have been the most exciting, fun couple of weeks or something to that effect. Did I hear you say that?
You did hear me say that, because
okay.
This is sort of This is new to me. I was not expecting, really, I was not expecting, you know, hundreds of people to come out and work with me and for me, you know, for their own seats in some cases, or just coming out and helping with and not being part of, you know, the political machinery in town. But we had a group of kids from like 15, you know, 16, 17, 18 year old high school students, all the way through people in their 90s. And they were, you know, they're coming to our headquarters, writing letters, writing postcards. It was an exhilarating experience because everybody got along. Like, we all really liked each other. And you have like typical squabbling between people with strong opinions who are, you know, very strong people.
Sure.
And everyone just, you know, put that aside. They talked things out and knocked doors. And for the first time, you know, I saw people knocking doors and not just talking about themselves, but they would start talking about a zoning candidate or, you know, a Board of Ed candidate. You know, quite often they'll hand literature to someone at the door and just talk about themselves and say, hey, look at these other people. But this was a serious team effort. And I, you know, what I think what I said is in one of the papers is, you know, I played team sports. I was a football player. I was not a great football player, but I was sort of always elected captain because that's what I love to do. I love to work in groups of people that are moving towards a goal. And really what I hope, and I think what everyone's going to feel, I hope, is that I'm going to be inclusive of everyone and try to, you know, make Fairfield a better place because I feel like I have a lot in common with anyone who believes in the democratic process and has something to offer. If someone is an engineer or an accountant or a finance person, I don't care what their politics are, as long as they can sort of put their personal egos aside and work together.
Sure.
With the goal.
So, Bill, the reason I ask you about that is because I got a very different vibe from the Kupchick campaign, and I don't remember where I heard or saw the quote, but this was basically 3 weeks of hell, even longer than that, for Brenda Kupchick's team, it sounds like. And I was getting from very reliable sources that there was a lot of social media attacks. There was a lot of hit below the belt going on from, I don't know if it was your campaign directly, but from the Democratic side towards the Kupchick team. So it was a very different, it felt like, run for her than it was for you. And I'm just wondering if you can confirm or deny if, in fact, there was, dare I say, like social media bullying going on as a tactic, you know, to up until the election.
I actually don't really know exactly what you're referring to. I have a sense because people, I was not really watching this stuff. I was getting screenshots from people. I think, honestly, that there is a degree of of not practicing what one is preaching. I think, you know, for example, I got a screenshot of a member of the RTM basically saying that I'm an unemployed loser. This is someone I've known now for years, and without knowing my background, without knowing what I was doing, and the fact that, you know, I was no longer working for a large corporation, but doing my own thing, she basically called me out as an unemployed loser, and then there was.
So you were getting that same effect during it.
I would say that this was starting from their camp, and maybe they're going to say it's starting from our camp. But I don't think, you know, we were.
But you didn't send like nasty mailers or post things or things like that. Nobody from your campaign was doing that.
Oh, so our mailers were based on fact, and I have to say that. That was something that I was never really particularly comfortable with because I want to be nice and be, you know, collaborative with everyone. And the problem was that there were things going on in the Kupchick administration that people, the view they were getting was from the first select woman's weekly email, and which was, you know, for example, you know, we had a
Only because, Bill, so only because we're running out of time, I just want to really quick, because we could certainly have you back on. Obviously, you're going to be running the town of Fairfield, so you'll be back on plenty of times. But were there nasty mailers then? It sounds like there were.
No, I don't think they were nasty, and I think they were truthful. So, for example, the United Illuminating timeline. So the first Black woman would come out and say, I didn't know. I found out when you found out. Well, that's just not true. Or it may be true. That means she didn't read the material. So as someone running against her, someone who went and to the Siting Council website and read every single document on that, I knew that, you know, these presentations to her as long as 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago at least, contained you know, the words, hey, permanent easements in them, and I just don't think she read them. So, or she didn't hire a land use attorney. So as someone running against, you know, someone with my background running against someone who didn't pay attention to that, I feel that's a very important thing to point out, is that she did not pick up the phone and call a land use lawyer when United Illuminating came into her office. So if that's nasty, I would say no. I would say that is something people need to know when they make a decision about who they want running their town. And I think there are multiple things like that where, you know, when they saw these mailers pointing this out, oh, that's not fair. It's very fair. I mean, that is when you run with a record, you have to stand up for your record. And, you know, I think that's just important for people to know.
So, Bill Gerber, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing all of this with us. Like I said, I'm sure you're going to be coming back on pretty frequently, because we love to check in with Fairfield. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Have a good holiday next week, okay?
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on, Melissa.
Thanks, Bill. Absolutely. Again, Bill Gerber is the first selectman-elect for the town of Fairfield right here on WACC. All right, bird lovers out there, this sounds like at first a very sad story, but we promise it's actually a really good one. A type of bird was found dead on the shoreline, it seems, in the Milford area, and that sounds really awful, right? But it turns out there was an incredible record that was broken right here in the Western Hemisphere. And to give us the story and the exact details on this is Tom Anderson, our friend over at the Connecticut Audubon Society, to explain the oldest black-bellied plover in Western Hemisphere. This is pretty extraordinary, Tom, so thank you for coming on and sharing it with us. We appreciate it.
Always happy to be on. Good morning.
Good morning. So first of all, tell us about this species in particular.
Yeah, sure. So I think maybe the last time I was on with you, we talked about piping plovers, which plovers are a kind of shorebird. Some people call it plover. Some people call it plover. It's a type of shorebird. And we have piping plovers nesting at Milford Point. They're small and fairly rare. In fact, they're federally threatened. But there's a related bird called the black-bellied plover, which is bigger and much more common. And they're at Milford Point in fall and spring, and sometimes through the winter. They nest up in the Arctic, so they're migratory. Piping plovers are migratory, too. But black-bellied plovers are not generally here in the summer. So black-bellied plovers are... when you see them at Milford Point, to the non-expert, they look like a sort of undistinguished grayish speckled bird. In summertime, when they're breeding, and you'd see this when they pass through Milford Point in the spring, they really amazingly pattern, because they have black, basically from the eyes and chin, curving down under the neck and all the way to the belly, which is where they get their name, black-bellied plover. And they're maybe a little bit bigger, between like a robin and a crow in size. So they're not tiny by any means. And the story is that back in the middle of October, a fellow who was birding at Milford Point came upon a dead black-bellied plover, as you mentioned, right along the high tide line, and went over to look at it and noticed that it had an identification band on its leg.
Oh.
And bird banding is a thing that ornithologists use to try to get records of where birds have been at certain points in their life.
When so it's totally safe, and this is very common.
Oh yeah, very very, very common. Yeah, and it's a It's a widespread, although not particularly efficient, way of getting information. And the reason it's not very efficient is because bird banders put bans on lots of birds, but most of them just go off and we never,
and you never see
hear
them
about
again.
The band. We never see them again. Yeah, exactly. We have a couple of people on Connecticut Audubon staff and also volunteers who are, you have to have a federal license to do it, they're licensed to do it. So he found this band. The bird was had not started to decompose, and it had not been, you know, scavenged by anybody. It was in pretty good shape, so it looked like it had died fairly recently. He took the band off and took it home. And the process is that when you do this, you go to the website of the U.S. Geological Service, which maintains all banding records. In other words, if you put a band on a bird, you then send that record to the U.S. Geological Service, and it has a vast database.
And what did this reveal?
Well, this band revealed that the bird had been banded in 2010 right across the river from Milford Point at Short Beach in Stratford.
Wow.
And the band also revealed that when bird banders put the bands on a bird, they are experts in looking at the bird's plumage and determining roughly how old it was. And so it was determined that this bird had hatched in 2009 or earlier. So it was at least 14 years old.
Wow. I mean, how old do they usually live?
Well, 6, 7, 8 years.
Oh, my gosh. So it way outkicked its coverage. Wow.
Yeah. So the fellow who found it, a guy named Chris Unsworth, who lives up in Cheshire, he used to be involved with the Coastal Center, and he emailed us the information because he knew a 14-year-old bird was unusual. And when I saw it, it eventually made its way to me. I I thought, oh, this is pretty interesting. I'm going to look into it. So I went to a website maintained by the Cornell Ornithology Lab. It's like an online bird encyclopedia called birdsoftheworld.org. And I looked up black-bellied plover. And what I found is that in Europe, the oldest on record was 20 years old. But in the Western Hemisphere, the oldest bird on record was only 12 years old.
Wow.
So I thought, you know, I mean, I used to be a newspaper reporter, and I know that when you hear something that sounds too good to be true, check it out just in case. So I emailed the bird banding lab, and I said, this is the record we have, and this looks like it's the oldest bird, the oldest black-bellied plover on record in the Western Hemisphere. They got back to me after a couple of days and said, essentially, yeah, you're right. It's the oldest black-bellied plover on record in the Western Hemisphere.
This is a very feel-good story for Connecticut residents, no matter where you're waking up and where you're heading off to this Friday morning. Pretty cool story from the Connecticut Audubon. There was a discovery, actually, earlier this fall of a bird, the black-bellied plover. It was. It sounds like a sad story because it was, well, it was found dead on the shore in Milford, and that sounds awful, right? But when they checked to see the band that was on that bird, not only is it a Connecticut bird, it was actually tagged right across the way in Stratford, but also this, it turned out to be the oldest black-bellied plover on record in the Western Hemisphere. I'm curious, we have Tom Anderson here to talk more about this. How did this plover live so long? What do you think it allowed it to outkick the coverage of the record? I mean, pretty substantially.
Yeah, I would have to say it was largely a matter of luck, but it's hard to know. Black-bellied plovers nest in the Arctic, so it hatched in 2009 or earlier, in probably late June, early July, flew south and spent the fall and maybe winter and spring, probably in the Milford area, then went north again to breed, and, you know, back and forth all those times. The fact that we don't have any records of birds that are older seems to show that it's an outlier, and sometimes these things are just, you know, just lucky. It just happened to not get eaten by a snowy owl in the Arctic or get caught by a fox on the beach at Milford Point. No way to know. One thing worth saying, though, is that we only know it's the oldest black-bellied plover on record because of the leg band.
Right.
We can assume that there are other birds out there that are older that were never banded, and there also might be some birds that were banded in the bands that just never recovered. So
right.
It's the oldest on record. It doesn't mean it's absolutely the oldest one ever.
But it proves the point that you're doing some great work with, you know, checking, you know, migration and population numbers and the health of these birds and the fact that the system that you're in the midst of doing to track all these things, it's working. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary to even be able to say it was here in Connecticut that we found, at least on record, the oldest black-bellied plover in the Western Hemisphere. That's got to feel really good.
Yes, it actually is kind of amazing. And it also shows how great that habitat is around the lower Housatonic River, because that bird has been presumably going back and forth for 14 years and finding the food and shelter that it needs to survive. You know, that we've got the beach and the sandbar at Milford Point. We've got the Wheeler Salt Marsh, which is about 800 acres. There are all the beaches on the other side of the river in Stratford, plus Stratford Point, which is our sanctuary. And then the Lordship Marshes, which are another, I don't even know how big, 500, 600 acres. And the beach at Long Beach in Stratford and Bridgeport. It's all really one big mosaic of habitats, and it's just a great place for birds, and this bird has obviously been using it and thriving there.
And I think it's another call for people to not only, like you were saying, you know, at Milford Point Coastal Center, they've made such a huge point of trying to protect these bird species and their nests. We have seen, you know, we talk about it all the time with Greg Dantrow from the Beardsley Zoo, the fact that our eagle numbers in Connecticut or just in general are at a much healthier place than they were in recent history. So I think this also brings attention to the art of bird watching, but also respecting our birds in Connecticut. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, 100%. That's a good point. And thank you for bringing it up. We always ask people, we encourage bird watches, obviously, at Milford Point and out on the sandbar. But our advice is always to keep your distance, look at them or photograph them with either a scope or binoculars or a camera with a powerful lens. And the general rule of thumb is that if you've moved so close to the birds that the bird has flown away, you've gotten too close. So you need to learn from that and keep your distance. Birds not only need food, which is plentiful at Milford Point, but they need rest after migration. And even little things like making them fly from one side of the Housatonic to the other because you walk too close, depending on the health of the bird, can stress it out.
Yeah, certainly. So, Tom, what is the website if people wanted to learn more from Connecticut Audubon and if they wanted to, you know, whether it's this story or many others that you guys publish on your site, what is it?
Well, our website is ctaudubon.org. And if they want to look at this in particular, and there's more to it than we've talked about, if you look across the drop-down menus on the top, there's one that says What's New, and our blog is called Natural Selections. When I wrote this a couple days ago, I placed it on the blog, so it's easy to find. And also, if you Google Connecticut Audubon and black-bellied plover, it'll show up first thing, so that's an easy way to find it. And once you're there, you can scroll around and look for other interesting bird stories as well.
Very cool. Well, Tommy Anderson, we always appreciate having you, Director of Communications for the Connecticut Audubon Society and Editor of Connecticut State of the Birds. We appreciate your time and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for the call.
Of course. Tommy Anderson again here on WICC. We love to talk about our birds here in Connecticut, and what a cool story. Amazing. Kudos to you, Connecticut.